After his enlightenment, the first talk that the Buddha gave testified to the reality of suffering, the cause of suffering, the fact that suffering can come to an end, and the path that can be followed to end suffering. He called these insights into suffering and its end the Four Noble Truths. He uncovered them for himself in his own meditation, and he taught that all humans had the potential to understand these truths and to reach the end of suffering that he described. When the Buddha spoke about freedom from suffering, he wasn't talking about feeling a little bit better. It wasn't about getting a little more comfortable or feeling a little less bugged by things. He wasn't talking about a kind of happiness that depends on getting what you want all the time or on having everything go one's way. He was really talking about something quite radical. He was talking about ultimate happiness or peace. This is a kind of peace that doesn't depend on external circumstances working out the way we want them to. It's something that comes from deep wisdom and inner transformation. So this deep peace that the Buddha described and held out as a possibility for all of us is actually something that really can't be described in words. So typically, it's described by what's absent in this peace or freedom rather than what comprises it. Specifically, what's absent in this type of peace are three things: ignorance, attachment, and aversion. Ignorance, attachment, and aversion are the three root causes of all of the afflictions that our minds endure. So I'd like to focus for a little bit on aversion, and particularly forms of aversion like anger and resentment. The reason I'd like to focus on this is that the main topic of tonight's talk is forgiveness. And forgiveness can play a very powerful role in healing anger and resentment. And because of that, forgiveness can be a powerful part of our path to the end of suffering. So anger and forgiveness, they can be very touchy subjects. I think the reason that they're such touchy subjects is that anger is usually triggered by hurt, disappointment, some type of pain. And often when one is feeling hurt, the idea of forgiveness can seem to be invalidating somehow. Some people think that forgiveness is like condoning or excusing injustices or abuses or harm that they've experienced. It's like saying that what happened was okay. But in the context of meditation practice, in the context of the Buddha's teachings, I don't interpret forgiveness that way at all. Really, the Buddha repeatedly emphasized the importance of distinguishing between harmful actions and unharmful or non-harming actions. And he emphasized the importance of choosing actions that are non-harming as an essential and enormous part of this path to the end of suffering. So in this context, if we really want to choose non-harming, we have to know what it is. So it wouldn't serve the main purpose of the meditative path to pretend that something which was harmful was really okay. That's actually delusional. So on the one hand, pretending that something harmful was okay is not what forgiveness is about. But on the other hand, the other extreme of acknowledging that something is harmful could be stewing in anger. And stewing in anger only hurts one more. Those of you who've had the opportunity to meditate when you're angry, the opportunity, you might have noticed that when the mind is angry, it can review its grievances over and over. You might be sitting there looking peaceful, but you're doling out blame and plotting revenge. One of the things that I really find interesting about the angry mind is that it can start to anticipate future grievances and get mad at things that haven't actually occurred and that might never occur. I speak from experience. So it's very clear that a mind that's lost in anger in this way is really on fire. And in that light, however justifiable the anger might be, in other words, however wronged or however wounded one might really have been, the anger becomes a second source of hurt on top of the original hurt. And in many cases, it really keeps the original hurt locked in place. I've personally been very moved by the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which tried to bring resolution and healing, or reconciliation, to South Africa after the awful brutality of apartheid. And many of you might know that Archbishop Desmond Tutu headed the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he wrote a book about it called No Future Without Forgiveness. It's a wonderful book, and I'd like to read a short quote from it. In forgiving, people are not being asked to forget. On the contrary, it's important to remember so that we should not let such atrocities happen again. Forgiveness does not mean condoning what has been done. It means taking what happened seriously and not minimizing it. Drawing out the sting in the memory that threatens to poison our entire existence. Drawing out the sting in the memory that threatens to poison our entire existence. That's what forgiveness is really about. In Bishop Tutu's book, I can't remember why, but he mentioned an American woman named Marietta Jager. And about 25 years ago or more, Marietta Jager was in Montana on vacation, and her 7-year-old daughter, Susie, was abducted and murdered. I became very interested in her and looked her up on the internet and found quite a lot of articles about her and by her. And she described her feelings after her daughter's kidnapping. This is what she said. At first, I was ravaged with hatred and a desire for revenge. I was seething. Looking back, she said she could have killed the man who had killed her daughter, quote, with my bare hands and a smile on my face. She said, I had every right to feel the way I did. But by the time Miss Jager's daughter's kidnapper was caught, prosecuted, and convicted, which was over a year later, she said, I was convinced that my best and healthiest option was to forgive. In the 20 years since losing my daughter, I've been working with victims and their families, and my experience has been consistently confirmed. Victim families have every right initially to the normal, valid human responses of rage. But those persons who retain a vindictive mindset ultimately give the offender another victim. Embittered, tormented, enslaved by the past, their quality of life is diminished. However justified, our unforgiveness undoes us. Anger, hatred, resentment, bitterness, revenge, they are death-dealing spirits, and they will take our lives on some level as surely as Susie's life was taken. I believe the only way we can be whole, healthy, happy persons is to learn to forgive. That is the inexorable lesson and experience of the Gospel of Marietta. Though I would never have chosen it so, the first person to receive a gift of life from the death of my daughter was me. So, forgiveness is very powerful stuff, but it doesn't usually come easily to most of us. In fact, I was one of those people it did not come very easily for. And I recall the first time I heard a Dharma talk about forgiveness. It was here in this building when the Dharma Hall used to be on the first floor. And I became really upset afterwards because I just thought, there's no way I could do this. I'm not capable of forgiving. Fortunately, I got a great piece of advice about this not long afterwards. I went to a workshop by Stephen and Andrea Levine, and they were teaching the forgiveness meditation. And Stephen said, if you're going to try this meditation out, don't start with the 500-pound weights. He said, start with the 2 to 3 pound weights. So in other words, don't start with the injustices or abuses that have been most grievous or wounding. Start with the lesser hurts. And shortly after that, I went off to my first 3-month meditation retreat, and I decided that that would be a great opportunity to try the forgiveness practice. And I decided that I would start trying the forgiveness practice by working on the anger I was feeling towards a specific friend of mine. Not long before the retreat, I'd been in a situation with this friend where something happened that upset me. What happened was not my friend's fault by any means, but it occurred in his presence. And so I expressed my feelings about it, thinking I could be vulnerable with him. And he said, oh God, I thought we were going to have a fun evening. Well, I was taken aback and I was angry. I was hurt. So I decided that this was going to be the person I started trying to do the forgiveness practice with because it wasn't a grievous wound. It was a 3-pound weight. Although for me at the time, I really could have held on to it for years. So every day I practiced forgiveness for a short time towards my friend. And at first it really was hard. My heart felt very hard towards him. And I should tell you what the forgiveness practice is that I was doing and that's traditionally taught. I was taught to imagine my friend in my mind's eye and really get a sense of him. And when I got the sense of him and really felt a connection, for better or for worse, I was to repeat the phrase, for any way in which you may have harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive you. for any way in which you've harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive you. So like I said, it was hard, and I would be repeating these phrases of forgiveness, and at the same time, there'd be another part of my mind blaming him and yelling at him. But by the end of the 3 months, an enormous change had occurred. My heart really felt soft. There was no anger left at all. I felt kindness, I felt compassion, and I respected him. I had a bit of a surprise, though, because I had prior to this thought that, well, if you have these good feelings about somebody, you would want to continue being friends. But I didn't. What I realized over the course of the retreat was that this particular incident was really just the worst in a series of smaller episodes where I wasn't being treated the way I wanted to be treated. So I found that I really could experience a very full feeling of forgiveness in my heart, a very deep letting go of anger. But it didn't mean I had to let go of my good judgment. I could choose who I wanted to be close to. So gradually I went on to forgiving more difficult people. And in the years since I've been teaching, I've always enjoyed working with meditators who want to try this forgiveness practice out. And I always pass on Stephen and Andrea's advice about starting with the smaller hurts and working your way up. I emphasize this advice, though, even more when I'm working with a meditator who has really undergone some kind of serious trauma or abuse, particularly childhood trauma or abuse. I'd like to take a moment to explain why. I find that, especially in spiritual circles, we meditators can often feel this internal pressure to forgive. It's like we should forgive our most grievous wounds, and we should do it right now. And sometimes there can be a social pressure towards this too. And when somebody has experienced not just abuse, but the kind of abuse that occurs in childhood that can be so confusing on top of damaging, this feeling that I should forgive can become an extra burden on an already overburdened psyche. And so what happens when forgiveness becomes a should is that the anger often intensifies rather than diminishes. And the anger in this situation is most often directed towards oneself. So in situations like this, I would recommend dropping the forgiveness practice and really focusing on compassion instead, particularly compassion for oneself and one's pain. If one is still interested in forgiveness and the forgiveness practice, one can stick with the smaller wounds for as long as one needs to. Remember, there's really no time clock for healing. There's no time clock for any of this. And also remember that compassion really is the greatest healer. At any rate, whether one is dealing with trauma, abuse, or some more lesser, typical, everyday wound, I've also found that it tends to be easier to come to a fullness of forgiveness after one's allowed oneself to feel the hurt and the pain that usually underlie the anger. In other words, forgiveness can't be used as a way to bypass difficult feelings or experiences. Rather, these things have to be experienced in a meditative way and opened to. Archbishop Tutu was not using a formal Buddhist practice to explore and open to the pains of apartheid, but he also described this process. He said, "None of us possess a kind of fiat by which we can say, 'Let bygones be bygones,' and hey, presto, they then become bygones. Our common experience, in fact, is the opposite. That the past, far from disappearing or lying down and being quiet, has an embarrassing and persistent way of returning and haunting us, unless it has in fact been dealt with adequately. Unless we look the beast in the eye, we find it has an uncanny habit of returning to hold us hostage. Unless we look the beast in the eye, we find it has an uncanny habit of returning to hold us hostage." In meditative practice, this process of looking the beast in the eye is not an intellectual or psychotherapeutic process. It's about feeling the hurt mindfully. It's about bringing the hurt into the light of non-discursive, compassionate awareness. Bringing mindfulness and compassion to the angers and the hurts often relieves a lot of the anger. Just the mindfulness and compassion itself will relieve some of the anger. Looking back, it's interesting for me that I needed to practice forgiveness for 3 months to deal with a so-called 3-pound weight. Because subsequently, I found that when I could bring heartful awareness to even the heavier hurts in my life, I found that the mindfulness and compassion would loosen up or relieve so much of it that my heart responded much more readily to the forgiveness practice. I still benefited from the forgiveness practice and I still use it, but it doesn't take as long now. The point I'm trying to make is that mindfulness and compassion promote forgiveness. They support forgiveness. And at the same time, forgiveness also supports and promotes mindfulness. Mindfulness, of course, is the main meditation technique that is being taught here in this center. And with mindfulness meditation, the whole path is about being fully present in the moment. Wakefulness in the moment is what we're practicing, what we're doing as we sit and walk in meditation, and as we pay attention to whatever it is that we do in our daily lives. So it's all about being here now. And one of the questions one could ask oneself is, how can we be fully present if our attention is repeatedly dragged back to the unresolved pains of the past? So forgiveness plays a powerful role in healing the heart and mind and the pains of the past so that the mind is freed up to be present, to be in the moment, fresh and unencumbered. Those of you who have already been exposed to the Buddha's teachings know that it's not just anger and blame that keep us from being awake and free in the moment. Another big bugaboo is this allusion to a sense of a separate self that we all tend to fall into. It's this often subconscious belief that there's a me which is completely distinct from you, or an us that is completely distinct from the others. This illusion of a separate self and separate others brings about tremendous alienation and suffering. So forgiveness plays a role in dispelling this illusion and this source of suffering too. To clarify how forgiveness does this, I'd like to backtrack for a minute and look at how anger intensifies this illusion of separation and this illusion of a separate self. Usually, when one's angry, there's a feeling that I have been wronged by an other. Next time you're angry, look to see if that's present. And look to see if it's accompanied by a sense of interconnectedness or a sense of separation. The sense of separation is a telltale sign of identification with a sense of self. And this sense of self is further hardened by identifying with roles in our lives that we see as being who I am, me. It could be one's professional role or the job one does, could be a role in a family or in a community or any kind of role. But when anger is the topic of the day, a key role that comes into play is the role of victim. Especially when one has been hurt repeatedly or severely, the role of victim can easily become part of one's identity or sense of self, one's sense of who I am. It starts to feel like I am one who has been maligned, misunderstood, abused, harmed, oppressed. And along with this sense of a victimized I comes a sense of an other who is a perpetrator or victimizer. It's very easy to fall into this. Please rest assured that I'm not in any way denying the very real abuses that go on in our lives and in the world. There are so many of them. And we need to have great compassion for all of our wounds. But the problem comes about when wounds get hardened into unchanging identity. Sometimes they even become the essence of who we think we are, or the primary topic of all of our thoughts. When this happens, we miss out on deeper truths, like the truth of the nature of awareness, which is boundless and empty of an unchanging, solid self. We miss out on the truth of our interconnectedness, and we miss out on the truth of the lack of separation between beings, no matter what their roles or actions. So forgiveness can help to dismantle this sense of identification with self and other, or victim and perpetrator. And in this way, it can free our energy up and help us to connect with a deeper level of experience. Now, the sense of self and other, I've been talking about how with anger we're often angry at the other. But I'm sure many, many people in this room have seen that sometimes our harshest anger and blame is towards ourselves. We can be brutally unforgiving towards ourselves for even minor shortcomings. So I wanted to let you know that the forgiveness practice can be used to forgive oneself. It's just a slight modification of the phrase. If you want to try forgiving yourself, again, you, in meditation, connect with a sense of yourself, however that works for you, viscerally in your body or in your mind's eye, and say the phrase to yourself, "For any way that I have harmed myself or others, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive myself. For any way that I have harmed myself or others, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive myself." Recently, I taught this self-forgiveness practice to a student. This student is a recovering alcoholic, and apparently in his drinking days, he'd done a lot of very destructive things. By the time I met him, he'd been sober for decades. He'd been meditating for many, many years. This was a person who had truly cleaned up his act. But he was still plagued by these memories of what he did in the past. And along with those memories came quite a lot of self-doubt and shame. So I suggested that he try the self-forgiveness practice. He worked on it for a while, and then he dropped me a note in the mail. And it was a short note, pretty much said this: "I've noticed that the memory flashbacks are less frequent. When they come, I am mindful that all this is a result of delusion then and now." So anyone who's been plagued by flashbacks of painful memories, whether one was the victim, the perpetrator, the bystander, or in some other role, knows what a relief it is when these memories abate. So I hope you can see from what I'm saying the profound relief, the joy, the peace that forgiveness can bring. Relief from the pains of anger and blame, relief from this burdensome identification with a sense of self and other, and an ability to live unhampered by the past, fully present in the moment. So given the joys of forgiveness, I'd like to push a little bit further with looking at what blocks us from forgiving, but really especially to look at how we can promote forgiveness in our own lives. I've found out that I was not the only person who initially thought that forgiving was just too hard to do. I've also noticed that sometimes when people think it's too hard to do, really what's going on is that they don't really feel motivated to forgive, or they don't really feel willing. There's a man named Fred Luskin who runs the Stanford University Forgiveness Project, and they do research there on forgiveness and run workshops. I read a book by him not long ago, and he described a man named Mike who attended one of his workshops. Mike said that his bosses had promised him a job as a web designer. This is Stanford, California, you know. And they reneged on the promise. So Mike was doing technical writing instead, and he was really unhappy about it. He said that his bosses were liars, and it wasn't possible to forgive such liars. So
Dr. Luskin wrote about an interaction he had with Mike. He said, "I asked Mike to imagine that $20 million was deposited in a Swiss bank account in his name. The money was his on one condition, that he agree not to think harshly again about his grievance. He was to imagine that the bankers had a thought detector that would know if he still held negative thoughts about his bosses. If they caught him in vengeful or angry thoughts, he would lose the money." I asked him if, in this scenario, he could let go of his grievance. Mike replied, "Of course I could." "My mama didn't raise a fool. And only a fool would give up $20 million. So I said to Mike, "Well, we're really talking about your motivation to forgive, not whether your bosses should or could be forgiven. It's obvious that it's okay to forgive your bosses. You just won't do it until you have a good enough reason." So for Mike, $20 million was sufficient reason. And that would do it for me, too. Nobody's offered me money to forgive anyone. And I don't think any of you are going to be offered money for it either. But forgiveness offers us something more precious. As I have been relentlessly saying, forgiveness offers us inner peace. So if we can keep this in mind, and if we really value inner peace, then perhaps we can find the motivation and the willingness to forgive. So having the willingness helps. And another thing that's useful is compassion. In my observation and life experience, I've come to believe that people do not hurt each other from states of happiness, wisdom, joy, and ease or comfort. Rather, I think we hurt each other from states of suffering like fear, greed, or the delusion of separation. Hurting each other from a place of suffering doesn't make harmful actions okay, but it does make them more human. It makes them more understandable. As a child, I felt harmed by a particular adult in my life, and I did not understand why she acted the way she did, and I could not forgive her. And then as a young adult, I began meditation practice, and over the years, I became very, very familiar with states of fear. These were states of fear as they arose in my own mind. It wasn't particularly associated with this adult from my past. But one day I was thinking about this adult and the lights went on. I just saw really clearly that this adult and her unkindness were motivated by fear. I didn't know what her personal story was. I didn't know the psychological content or what she was afraid of. But because I knew fear so well in my own heart and mind at that point, I could recognize it in her in retrospect. Understanding that her unkindness was motivated by fear gave me compassion for her, and finally, I could forgive her. Up until now, I've been focusing on how we can find forgiveness in our own hearts, cultivate it for ourselves as part of our path towards, in a sense, our own liberation, however one could describe somebody's liberation as being just for themselves. But There are actually relational ways of promoting forgiveness, and so I want to mention some of them. The most obvious one is that when we realize that we have harmed or hurt somebody else, whether intentional or unintentional, we can apologize or make amends. There was a research study that was done in the late 90s where college students were asked to answer a series of questions about some kind of transgression or violation that they'd experienced. The researchers found that the students reported greater forgiveness when the perpetrators acknowledged committing the offense, when they sincerely apologized, and when they expressed feelings of remorse or sadness for what they had done. In contrast, when perpetrators responded defensively, like with insincere apologies or with blaming the victim, there were lower rates of forgiveness reported. I think we've all been in situations like this, especially in situations where we've given or received insincere apologies. You know what they sound like? Well, sorry. Or another one that I've done a lot is, well, I'm sorry, but you know, I never would have done that if you hadn't. Da 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 da. So it's familiar. And it's not really convincing, and it's not really healing for anybody. So, when we actually apologize sincerely, one of the things that's going on is there's an acknowledgement of the other person's pain and a caring about it. That acknowledgement is what's so healing. It decreases the sense of separation for both parties. And of course, when one has been hurt, if one receives the apology, it's easier to forgive. So I think that in a social world where it's very easy to hurt or offend each other, and it can be so hard to let go of the wounds, a sincere apology becomes a very profound act of kindness. It's also very powerful to accompany apology with actual changes in behavior when necessary. In my life, there's a person who I used to repeatedly lose my temper with. And when I did this, I would apologize sincerely afterwards. But then, sometime not long after that, I would do it again, be yelling at him excessively. So the apologies were getting a little empty. And finally, I really took a hard look at myself and figured out how to change my actual behavior. I stopped losing my temper. So then when he would do things that I disliked, I was able to stay calm and handle it in ways that were more conducive towards some kind of harmonious relationship between us. So in this case, from my experience, the actual change of behavior was the deepest form of apology that I could make. It was certainly the more sincere form. I need to note, though, that while we might offer apologies, make amends, or change our behaviors, it's important to remember that people who hurt us might not have that interest or commitment. I have found it vital to remember that I can't let my well-being, my inner peace, hinge on whether or not someone apologizes to me. It is much easier to forgive with an apology But when one really wants deep peace or freedom, sometimes forgiving without an apology is the only way to go. It's getting late. I think I'll wrap it up. You know, in our culture, it's often considered quite rational to be angry at someone who's hurt us. And forgiveness, in a way, could be seen as something that is not totally rational. It transcends rationality. Forgiveness doesn't mean giving up our common sense. But in transcending rationality, perhaps it does involve letting go of the limited mental confines that we often occupy. Instead, forgiveness can move us into something deeper. And this is very in keeping with the whole spiritual path, because in a way, one could say the whole meditative or spiritual path involves transcending rationality on some level. So perhaps forgiveness is an aspect of the happiness that I started talking about at the very beginning of the talk tonight, this happiness that can't be described with words or understood with the rational mind. I recently read an article by a woman named Olga Bacharova, and she put the same idea a little bit differently. She was describing extensive work that she's done on conflict resolution, community building, and reconciliation amongst the peoples of the former Yugoslavia after the various wars there and the Bosnian genocide. And she wrote about the depth of trauma that people underwent, the great difficulties of healing, and the role that forgiveness often played in transforming their lives. She said, "The past cannot be restored, but the transformed person is no longer the person who needs that past. Forgiveness reveals the true meaning of suffering as a reuniting with the spiritual strength on a deeper level. Forgiveness transforms suffering. This is the time when the spiritual core of human nature is celebrated. This is the time when the spiritual core of human nature is celebrated. That ability to transform even horrible suffering, and the role that forgiveness can play in that." So let's sit for just a few moments.
So those of you who need to leave can feel free to do so, and those of you who want to stay for some discussion can feel free to do so. So, what's on your minds? Yeah.
Hi, thank you for your talk. It's great. I'm kind of in the middle of an argument with somebody right now. Right before I came into the meditation, and they gave me some feedback, and then about something, and then I called them back, and we kind of got into it. And it's a really good friend of mine, and it's basically he feels that I'm not there for him. And I feel he's not seeing things clearly. And I think when I got out of the meditation, it was kind of fiery because I was angry. So it was a perfect topic. it's like happening right now. But I did have some moments of peace. And, you know, I think I just accepted that what was happening. And I guess at the end, I kind of realized, yeah, I don't commit to things. And that could be what he's sensing, and I also think he just needs to accept that I'm not perfect. And I'm not quite sure why he's even upset with me, because I agreed to help him, and it's just beyond anything that, it's just beyond, and he thinks I don't go beyond for him. I guess that's the thing. And I already agreed to do something, and then it's like he's mad because of the way I did it. He just didn't accept that I'm helping. He just thinks the way I agreed to do it is wrong. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is, it sounds like a close relationship, and these tend to have more complexities to them. I think one of the things it sounds like you've started to do is a good thing. Just looking really closely at, well, what's going on for me? You know, like sometimes when we're having an argument or a disagreement with someone that we're close to, their words might be, you know, you were blaming me for this. And you say, no, I wasn't, because that's not the way you experience it. But if you sit down, not you in particular, but one, you know, sits down and thinks, well, what was going on with me? It might be that, you know, blame isn't what was going on for you, but it might be, oh, I was feeling really defensive and I felt like I should, you know, strike out before he strikes at me or something like that. You know, it might be something slightly different, but that for him could have been experienced as blame and for you could have been experienced as something else. So I know that's not the specifics of what you're working on, but the concept of just making sure that you check in with yourself and really seeing what your own motivation is first. Now you may do that and still come up with, wow, I think my motivation was pretty wholesome. You know, I think I really did my best. And I really don't, you know, I mean, you may come up with that.
Another thing you can also do is inquire more about what is going on for him and what he's really feeling like. Draw him out a little bit. But if you still come up for yourself with feeling like, I really feel like I'm in a pretty wholesome place with this, I think sometimes it just boils down to we occasionally get accused of things that we don't really feel we did. And if there's a possibility of caring about the person within that and also caring about yourself and taking care of yourself, I think that's the best you can do. Human relationships are really sticky. So I don't know if that helps, but yeah, good. Sure.
I've had the experience of working at forgiving someone and feeling good about that, and then feeling like it comes back again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be that either I've had some kind of renewed contact with the person, or a phone call, or a card, or, you know, whatever, or saw a movie that reminded me of the whole thing again, and it's... So I feel like, in a way, it has a life of its own, and that I've worked a lot with people who have had extreme losses, and I've noticed that the experience of grief really kind of comes and goes, and that I feel like that's how forgiveness works for me in certain situations, that it's not just sort of like done.
Yeah, I think that it can be. Certainly, I've experienced that myself, and then other situations where it is done, and then maybe next year I'll find out it wasn't done at all. I mean, who knows? But I think it, you know, it also points to the fact that things aren't solid, and that really the only thing that ever happens is there's one moment. It's right now. So there's forgiving right now. There's being angry right now. And if there's another right now, we don't know what that right now will be. So there has to be this openness to whatever now has to offer us. And, you know, so forgive again, be angry again, forgive again, like that. Yeah.
So when you say get a connection with the other person in your mind's eye, so that could be an angry connection as well? Is that considered a connection?
I wouldn't shoot for that, no. What I meant was, to somehow, I think it's individual for people, but to somehow summons up a sense of the person. So some people are very visual, and they'll do it by picturing that person. Other people are more kinesthetic, and they might have a sense of the person's energy, and they'll just feel that person. But the idea is that, let's say you're mad at Joe. You don't want to just be saying, for any way that you've harmed me, kind of out in the world to anyone. You want to say it to Joe. So that's why you just get a sense of Joe. The anger is your feeling about Joe. So you want to just bring Joe to mind. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. Yeah, Laura.
What do you do if you're angry at not necessarily an individual, but you're angry at the universe or God or your body?
You know, I pulled all three of those things out of my talk because I have pages and pages of notes here. I have so many pages of notes here, we would have been all night, so I just skipped over that part. But since you asked, yeah. You can really be creative with the forgiveness practice. Just modify the phrase. I know people who have used it to forgive their bodies, and they've either done it for their body in general or a specific part of their body. For any way that you've harmed me, or for any pain that, you know, what you can be creative, whatever feels right to you, for any pain that's associated with you, I forgive you. You can say that to your body. In terms of the universe
or life or God, same thing. I definitely know people who've done that. Just adapt the phrase in any way that works. Life for any way that you've harmed me. Life for being so difficult. I forgive you. Life for all of the ups and downs, and especially the downs, I forgive you. Whatever phrase you resonate with. You can forgive also whole groups of people. You can forgive an entire gender, an entire economic class. You can forgive people from a certain political party that you might not belong to. People from a country that you don't like. Whatever it is, you know, be very expansive and creative. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to comment. I really appreciated your comments on compassion and the role it plays. And in the story that you described, it's harder for me if we're thinking of the universe or a country or some larger to feel the compassion, to feel connected, to feel one with, as a way of getting to forgiveness. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's harder with larger groups for some of us because, especially if they are very big groups, the mind... It's like almost sometimes like you need a representative, you know. So sometimes it helps to imagine representatives of the group or something like that to make it more specific and more real. And in terms of compassion, sometimes this can be accompanied with reflections. Normally in meditation, it's not about discursive thinking. But there are some skillful reflections that can be done before that are useful. I actually, in preparing for this talk, one of the things I thought was, you know, I wonder if there are people that I haven't forgiven that I kind of forgot to get around to. And I came up with somebody. And it was from a long time ago, and I haven't seen him in years because he moved away. And so I thought, oh... Gee, that's a tough one. And I didn't have a lot of compassion, so I sat down and reflected on, now what do you think 10 years later might have motivated him to act that way? And I came up with it. I came up with possible motivations. And I thought, now, what are the possibilities that I could ever act in ways that are remotely similar? And it was possible. And that brought me some compassion. So I don't know if that's the exact reflection that would work for you, but you can come up with, you know, maybe a reflection that matches your circumstance. So that's one idea. Yeah.
I want you to forgive me if I say something that's incorrect. It seems to me, in one way, that if we had what we call right view, we wouldn't need forgiveness because we wouldn't be holding on to anything that would cause us suffering. So, is this, and I ask this with sincerity, is this a small step? It seems to me that when you're thinking about how somebody might have done something wrong, you're giving that person a sense of self. The Buddhist philosophy does not hold. That I don't hold. So I'm thinking but I've got 50 years of believing that, or close to it, believing that, you know, a person is a self and a soul and a, you know, that there's something, an object. And only new views that this is all just reification. And when I can get to the new perspective and based on experience sitting and meditating, it seems to me that there's no need for forgiveness.
So would it be accurate to say that when you reflect on the anger, that the anger dissipates, so you don't need to practice a formal forgiveness practice? Is that part of what you're saying?
When I reflect on the anger?
Yeah, it says, like, you know, that when you revise your attitude, that the anger dissipates.
Yes, it does. Although I notice, as someone said, it has its power of its own. That's, you know, just a pattern repeating itself. And I notice the energy dwindling as I am mindful. So instead of, I guess I practice the forgiveness when I find myself angry at a particular person over a particular behavior that I felt victimized by. But I also have moments when forgiveness isn't a part of it and just mindfulness is a part of it, and not attributing a sense of self to that person and an agent who can decide to harm me willfully, but just as their, you know, that's their karma.
Well, I think the key here is there's a lot of things we know intellectually, and then our guts don't seem to get it. You know, like, we know everything's impermanent. We know there's no separate self. And then we go ahead and act as if things are permanent and as if we're permanent and we're somebody. So when one is in a place where your gut is getting it and the gut really sees deeply, there's no self, there's no other, there's no anger, there's no forgiveness necessary because it's all a done deal, then that's fine. Mindfulness really can be the best healer in town. And, you know, then for the rest of us who, you know, forget and the anger comes back or whatever, you know, forgiveness can just be supportive. It's not necessary. I mean, like, I'm kind of out as somebody who's an angry type. So that's why I'm giving this talk. I really needed this forgiveness practice. If you're not an angry type, it might be that this really isn't going to be the primary or a major source of meditative experience for you. It's really medicine for what ails you, if that helps.
Sitting here listening, so I fluctuate, you know, fluctuating states.
Yeah.
Sometimes more mindful, sometimes more angry.
Yeah, and so when you feel ailed by anger, if you want to try forgiveness, you can, and if you want to try mindfulness, you can. And I think I like to think of meditation as a living laboratory where one can really play with the different medicines that are available. Yeah.
One is that I'm imagining that the Buddha had some reason for encouraging people to do practices where we actually did imagine particular distinct people, like when we do metta practice or forgiveness practice, that we, you know, we're calling up in our experience a separate self, even though there aren't
an absolute level, there aren't separate selves. So I'm imagining that the Buddha had some idea that by doing that, it would help us to get to a place where we could dissolve those boundaries. And then I'm also thinking about what you said about different types, and that if somebody isn't necessarily an aversive type, that it might be really important to watch, or to, I guess I'm asking for ways to use one's wisdom so that one doesn't forgive too quickly, one doesn't lose one's compassion, sort of gloss over or forgive in a way that isn't genuine or helpful yet. You know, how to use one's wisdom in those ways.
Well, in terms of the first part of what you said about imagining that the Buddha instructed us to do things like loving kindness practice or other practices where you envision particular individuals even though there is no separate self, I can't say what went on in the Buddha's mind. I sure wish I could. but yes, I would say you use the phrase they ultimately really wind up dissolving a sense of boundaries, and that is my experience too. So that even though we start from that place, because we have to live with each other, there's a relative reality in which there's some level at which you're you and I'm me, and so it is a way of helping us make relative reality happier, more joyful, and more aligned with universal reality. In terms of people who, or times when any of us might have pseudo-forgiveness, or a forgiveness that's not really genuine, that can definitely happen. Mindfulness is the best medicine. It's really about paying close attention to what various mental states really feel like. Really paying attention to what resentment feels like, what pretend feels like, what a lot of times when there's a pseudo-forgiveness or a pseudo-compassion or something like that, there's a little striving in the mind. You can feel it reaching for something. And if you can tune in viscerally to that sense of creating something, there's an edge to it, an effort to it. And it's subtle. But that subtlety, you know, spotting it will deepen the mindfulness. And it's also a place where the Sangha comes in. With delusion, in particular, of the three things that I mentioned, ignorance, attachment, and aversion, delusion obviously is the hardest to see by definition. So it is a place where having feedback from other people who are looking deeply, teachers or other meditators or other people on other spiritual paths, ours is not the only valid one, that can be really helpful with delusion. I don't recommend going delusion alone. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you go the route of compassion for yourself, would you, are there certain phrases you would summon while you're meditating, or you think about?
Yeah, there's a formal compassion practice. The traditional phrase, I had to pause for a minute because I don't usually use the traditional phrase myself, but the traditional phrase is, may I be free from suffering. Some people don't like that phrase because it sort of makes them feel like they have an aversion to suffering. So another phrase that's very commonly used is, I care about me. Or I care about my pain. I care about my pain and sorrow. I'm just giving you little tiny variations. And you'll notice whenever you do something like compassion practice or forgiveness practice, that sometimes, you know, it'll get a little worse before it gets better.
Just as my own example with forgiveness, you know, I'm saying, you know, for any way that you've harmed me, I completely forgive you. And then at the same time, I'm going, you lousy thing, you know, bawling him out. You know, if you can kind of just ease your way into that and accept that that's part of the process. Yeah. Shall we call it a night? Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.